You've entered Bookstorm with Kristen Civiletto and me, Chris Storm. This is a podcast devoted to best-selling books that matter, books that make a difference. We're diving down deep with beloved authors about their stories. We're exposing hot-button topics and heartfelt themes, the issues that affect each of us in our own lives, as siblings, parents, partners, friends, as human beings. We're braving new ideas, fresh thoughts, hard lessons, and important truths. Those kinds of things that stay with us long after we turn the last page and close the book. Welcome back to Bookstorm Podcast, all you fiction lovers. And where are you located? Kristen and I are so excited. We have listeners in 80 countries, all 50 US states, and something like 1,600 cities. And we know the reason why. It's not because of Kristen and I, although we'd like to think so. It's because of great authors like we have with us today, Wabgishig Rice, and this new book that just came out, The Moon of Turning Leaves. And Wab, thanks for joining us on Bookstorm today.
Thanks a lot for having me, Chris and Kristen. Really honored to be here.
Well, before we get started, I want to tell our listeners a little bit about you because you have some wonderful accolades that were very hard-earned and well-deserved, and everyone's curious about you. So Wab is an author and journalist from the Wasauksing First Nation. He graduated with a journalism degree at Toronto Metropolitan University. He spent most of his career at the Canadian Broadcast Corporation as a video journalist and radio host. He left CBC to pursue his literary career, and we're all pretty happy that you did that. We're here to talk about The Moon of Turning Leaves, but in addition to his writing endeavors, Wab speaks on creative writing, oral storytelling, and the contemporary Anishinaabe culture, which is so very important. Thank you for that also. He received, and I have to mention this because it's quite an honor, the Anishinaabeg Nation's Debwewin Citation for Excellence in First Nation Storytelling. Wow. His work has starred reviews from places like Publishers Weekly, Library Journal, Booklist, and more. He lives in Ontario with his wife and three sons. We're excited to dive down deep into this story.
Thank you for having me and for that kind introduction. Wow, I'm very flattered. Miigwech, thank you.
Well, Wab, we are very excited to talk about this story. And I like to give our listeners just a little bit of a background of what's going on. And if you want to add anything, of course, we would welcome that. But for our listeners, I want to take us back to actually your first book. Now, Moon of the Turning Leaves stands alone. It is a fantastic, fantastic story. But it does also build on your other book that had come out and is a bestseller, Moon of the Crested Snow. So I want to take our listeners back just for a second there. Mm-hmm. In that story, a small northern community, the Anishinaabe indigenous tribe, it goes dark, panic sets in, and the food supplies dwindle. And people are starting to get worried and sick and frustrated. And a group of friends decides to turn to the land and the traditions of their heritage in the hopes of helping their community thrive again. Now, this story, Moon of the Turning Leaves, picks up around there. And the families begin to realize that when the lights went out, this may have been more widespread than they initially thought. In fact, something much bigger has happened, and that's something you delve into in the story. It keeps us riveted because, first of all, we're learning about how the Anishinaabe way would fare in this new world, in this new place that they find themselves. But also, we journey with them as they try to figure out, is there anyone else out there? Mm-hmm. Did you want to add anything to that little background there?
Oh, that all perfectly captures both stories, I think. Thank you for that excellent summary. I would just say, add that with Moon of the Crested Snow, it was inspired by a moment that I think a lot of your listeners may remember. That was the Northeast blackout of 2003. A wide section of the Northeastern United States and parts of Ontario and Quebec lost power one sunny summer day. And nobody knew why, and nobody knew when the power was going to come back on. And I was actually at home in my home community of Wasoxing that day. And although it was, you know, very unusual and eventually somewhat terrifying to have this mysterious blackout happen, because I was at home and surrounded by resourceful people who lived on the land, I felt really comforted just being, you know, there amongst some very skilled people who didn't need electricity or their cell phones or anything like that. So that's really the moment that started this whole saga that's now spanned two books.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And in fact, I remember this. And after that date, I remember with my kids, we started packing some things away and thinking about what would we do if we were in this situation. And I think that's why your book is, it just holds our attention for many reasons. And that's one of them, because you think, what would I do? Would I be able to survive? So thank you for sharing that.
Oh, my pleasure.
And it was only like a month ago that we all lost cell phone service. You remember that? Or like a couple of weeks ago. And Kristen and I were talking and I said, this is Wob's book. And I'm like, is that happening now? Not now. We're not ready yet.
Yeah. Oh, is, you know, anytime anything went out over the past 10 years since, you know, I started working on the first book, I've always had that like tingle at the back of my neck. You know, I was like, oh no, right? Am I ready enough? And I only have myself to blame for that reaction. You know,
we need a story like this. And I want to say for our listeners that Wob, through your story, you showed us the very best and the very worst of human nature. We all want to believe in a crisis that people would band together, but this probably is not true. However, you also showed us that the indigenous people did two very wonderful things in the midst of this crisis. One, they continued to respect the land. They did not overhunt or overuse it, despite devastation. Two, they kept giving thanks. It sort of blew my mind. Even in the midst of catastrophe and hardship. And I had to ask you as the author, how did both of these things keep them hopeful and maybe even moral? Because I can't help but believe that all of us in the real world today could learn a little something from both of these actions.
Yeah, it was important for me to try to convey that sentiment of communal response and of support in a time of crisis. And I think the indigenous point of view on that really is from a history of being essentially colonized, displaced, brutalized by colonial authorities, right? You can objectively argue that any modern country where indigenous people exist is a dystopia for those people because, you know, they've lost their homelands, their ways of life have been taken from them, and a lot of really difficult realities persist in communities where people are traumatized by history, history and so on, right? So I think with that lived experience, there's an understanding that it is possible to overcome a cataclysm, an apocalyptic event. There are beautiful things we can still hang on to and nurture, despite what those things have endured or what we collectively have endured. And that the best way forward really is together, you know, and understanding what we can offer each other, what we can bring to the collective as a whole, and how we can draw upon our natural surroundings to create that more, I think, harmonious and positive and healthy way of being in the aftermath of a big cataclysm like that. So, you know, it goes back to, you know, what I know of my family's history, my community's history, growing up on the Great Lakes, on the North Shore of Lake Huron and so on. And I think like those morals are really embedded in that resilience and in that understanding of survival. But I really want to underline for readers everywhere that it's not, you know, ultimately just an indigenous sentiment. I think at the core, all humans have that sense of community and survival and of moral, I think, fortitude when our backs are up against the wall, when we need to be that, because ultimately we all come from, you know, an agrarian land-based way of life. No matter who we are around the world, it's only been a few centuries that we've really been industrialized and have become reliant upon technology and so on. And really it's within all of us to be able to return to the land and reciprocate with it and be together in a good way. Right. So I think, you know, it's really about, I think, stepping away from our individual egos at times and really understanding what's best for the collective as a whole. And I think those are the kinds of things I wanted to get across in the story.
And they were so important. And also this issue of giving thanks. It's such a difficult thing to do when mm-hmm. you're in the midst of catastrophe, but there's something so simply wise about it. It mm-hmm. forces you to look at what is left that's good. And yeah. you can get down into such a dark, dismal pit of depression. The world's come to an end. We don't even know what's happening throughout the United States or Canada. But what can you expand on that just a little? What is this tradition of giving thanks in the Indigenous community, and how important is that?
That's really great to underline there, Chris. Thanks a lot for really going deeper into that. It goes back to that sense of reciprocity that I mentioned just a moment ago. You know, from a Anishinaabe, I think, practice, if we go out and harvest something from the land, whether it's an animal to eat or to create clothing with, or it's, you know, food or berries or medicine from the bush, you know, we'll give an offering of tobacco, which we call sema, back to the land. And you know, that is a symbolic gesture of giving thanks to creation for what we have harvested from it, right? And it's always that two-way relationship, no matter what. And that sort of extends to our interpersonal relationships with each other, with our wider community. And it gets back to that idea of staying humble as an individual, of knowing that we can't go it entirely alone and that we will need help regardless of the situation. You know, and I think, again, that sort of humbles us, and it really, more importantly, though, places us on the land and within, you know, our natural surroundings. And we understand just where we fit in and all the pieces that need to come together for the land to exist in a good, positive, healthy way that keeps us safe and happy and healthy as human beings, right? And it's just, you know, a good gesture to engage with on a daily basis, to be thankful for whoever made you your coffee or for the letter carrier who delivered the mail, you know, that I think reciprocity, as basic as that is, that's the kindness I think we need to extend to each other just as human beings to ensure that there is a sense of community no matter where we are.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that respect underlies stewardship. It's kind of a bedrock principle. Mm-hmm. And I love
exactly.
that. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, despite the horror that surrounded these characters, Evan says to Nagons, this is a quote from your book, and it's a beautiful one. "We know that the Anishinaabe way lives on down here, even after everything that's happened. For that reason alone, we have to believe in each other now. These trees give the breath of our ancestors back to us. This river returns the water that kept them alive. We have to carry that with us, follow the path." Can you talk a little bit more about the Anishinaabe way and the continuity that exists between the ancestors and the present day people?
Yeah, thanks for picking up on that. You know, that is a crucial moment in the story where they've come upon some major revelations about where the world is at that point and what their place is at the same time. It also recognizes their recent history of surviving this apocalyptic moment, right? The rivers have run much longer than humans have been around in this land. They will outlast any structure that we've built. And I think having that longer perspective of the essence of the natural world ties into that Anishinaabe knowledge of playing the long game, essentially. You know, these waters will flow, the winds will blow, the trees will grow much longer than we'll ever be here, right? And it's up to us to have respect for that and understand, again, as I mentioned earlier, our place within all of these natural surroundings. And, you know, I grew up understanding that from a very young age. And I really am fortunate and privileged in many ways that was my upbringing, you know, in the bush, on the res, and seeing just how important it is to exist within that wider, you know, natural sort of environment, essentially, right? So the Anishinaabe way is again, as we've touched on, just knowing your place there and being thankful, but understanding the forces that are much greater, you know. And in these stories, everything has fallen apart, you know. The temporary nature of what we've created as human beings comes to the fore. And what helps them survive and sustain themselves are things like the waterways, their knowledge of going out and harvesting from the land and so on. And I think it's just ensuring that we have that broader perspective of who we are as people and not just hyper focus on us as individuals, or within just our households, but know where we place ourselves within our communities and beyond, right? So yeah, having them, you know, recognize that at that point in the story, I think was pretty important.
Yeah, Chris and I have an ongoing conversation about this, about I think it's an intentional choice to think about where humans stand in relation to the natural world. And, you know, there are some people who believe we are better than it, more important. Some people believe we're equal, a part of it. But regardless, that intentionality about where you stand, I love the words that you use because I don't think a lot of people necessarily think about that until they have to. And, you know, here your characters already had some understanding, but they were all confronted with the have to now.
And
And really
hopefully it
good.
doesn't take a major catastrophe for us all to realize that. You know, that's the fun part of hypothesizing as an author is that you can create that scenario, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think we're already there in terms of what we've done to our waterways and our air and our land. So,
Well, while you
interesting
both
point.
were talking, I thought, you know, mankind is very egotistic, and we do think that we are the most important thing anywhere. However, nature will give us a good tsunami, a hurricane, a tornado, a snowstorm where you're from, and we're from Buffalo, New York, that sort of puts it in perspective a little bit. Man, you're not really in charge here. Time to have a little respect. Or when the electricity goes out, mankind loses what we think we need to survive, and then we turn to the indigenous people and see what really is important and how they learn to live with the land. I love that. But I've got to ask you this. So this hit me in a strong way because we all have parents and grandparents. The passing of the torch of responsibility or legacy from one generation to the next in your book and in the real world is tough. Nangon says, and I'm going to quote him, "What about us? The young ones, the next generation, the future. We didn't choose where we got to be born, but we trusted you to care for us, to love us, to make the right decisions. And you did, but we will still be here after you're gone. We deserve a say in the world that we're going to live in." And I had to ask you, as the writer, when and why should the older generation bequeath some of its power to the younger? But also the reverse, when does the younger need to continually understand that the older generation cannot be discarded, but that they deserve respect and a voice? I think these are two things that we're missing in today's culture.
Yeah, and you see that play out in the various terminology or labels amongst generations in mainstream culture, I guess. You know, you have boomers, Gen X, Gen Z, whatever else, right? Millennials. And you know, those are like strongly defined, I think, silos that people will just place you in if you're born in a certain era, right? And there's like conflict that arises between these attitudes and sensibilities and so on, right? But you know, it's really important to look beyond that. And I grew up always learning to respect my elders, understanding that they're the ones with the lived experience, they're the ones with the cultural, social, economic, political knowledge, and that it's important to defer to them because of those things. But then, as you grow older and a younger generation comes up behind you, you really understand that that intergenerational respect goes in either direction. It's supposed to, you know, even if you're amongst the adult sort of 20, 30, 40 generation that's, you know, at the engine of society or the economy or whatever else, there's still, you know, a generation up and coming that you're responsible for and that you have to leave a good place for. And there's those elders too, who have seen how different things play out and how you still need guidance, even as an adult in your 30s and 40s or whatever else, right? So, you know, and I also like to think that's not just an Indigenous way of being, not just an Indigenous value. I think inherently all humans everywhere should have that attitude when it comes to respecting the generations, both older and younger than us, right? And I think that really came to the fore in the initial months or year of the pandemic, when everything was locked down and there was so much confusion, mystery, tension, and so on. And you had, you know, some communities, you know, authorities, et cetera, ensuring that the elder generation was protected, right? The most vulnerable. And there was, you know, a subsection of society that felt that, oh, well, if I'm a young, healthy adult, then I should just be able to do whatever I want and take on this virus and deal with it on my own without thinking about the vulnerabilities on either end of the, I guess, generational spectrum, you know, the very old and the very young, right? And that, again, gets back to what we were talking about in terms of that individuality and that strong ego and so on. But where I'm from, you know, our community was locked down, and I live in Sudbury, a city about an hour and a half north of the reserve where I grew up. And I wasn't allowed to go back there because, you know, they didn't want sickness coming in and they wanted to protect the elders, which is something I totally supported. I was fine, but not having access to my home community because I wanted the elders to stay safe and healthy there too, right? So it's just interesting how you see those attitudes play out. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of humans have forgotten about the respect that goes in either direction when it comes to the generations in our lives. So I really wanted to highlight that in the story too.
I'm glad you brought it up because I feel like it's an old world culture sort of thing. No matter where your ancestors came from here in the United States, you know, we're a nation of immigrants. And mm-hmm. so all of us have come from somewhere else. And our grandparents and our great grandparents had that respect for elders mm-hmm. and the bringing up of youth, but somehow we've lost it today. Yeah. And thank you for sharing that about 911. That's something, I mean, not 911, but the pandemic mm-hmm. and maybe even 911. A crisis yeah. makes us look at each other a little more closely and care about each other, including in this story too. It taught us in the story. Thank you for sharing that.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it's good. It's good to highlight. It's good for all of us to remind ourselves that, right? I think.
Yeah. Especially today when, you know, identity plays an important role in a lot of people's lives, but we forget sometimes that our first identity might be as members of the human race. Mm-hmm. And exactly. So, you know, I think we could talk about that probably for 3 more hours.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, to me, it was very interesting to read your descriptions of the decimated places. You know, the detritus of life was just laying around and discarded. And I was thinking about, you know, there's things we think we depend upon and we need, like cell phones every day, which was kind of a very clever symbol throughout your story. But I wanted to ask you about the fact that if we did ever have to start all over, do you think that society would look vastly different? Or do you think humans are always trying to do things better, faster, with more technology? Do you think we would just race to where we are today?
That's a really interesting question, you know, and honestly, those were the most fun parts of the book to write, you know, thinking about the aftermath, showing the cities and the towns empty and dilapidated, but also wondering what's going to be left behind, what the remnants of the past life are, and how influential or useful they could be in this new era, right? And I think humans are just innovative by nature. I think if we lost everything, as these characters have in this story, eventually they'll find a way to recreate a lot of the same technologies that they once had. Maybe not to the same degree, because this story is about total collapse, right? So, you know, it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of time to get electricity generation happening again, if that can happen. And who knows about satellites and telecommunications and all that. That's going to take a long time to come back online too, if it ever does, you know. But in the spirit of the story itself, you know, what I really wanted people to be mindful of is, you know, condensing our communities and our societies and focusing on just our immediate, you know, surroundings and what we can create in terms of a healthy and happy and safe environment for our people within, you know, the immediate confines of our immediate world, you know. So I think that's the most important thing that would have to be established. And then from there, they would see about rebuilding wider societies or creating governance structures or whatever else. And then I think the technological resurrection could potentially happen after that, right? Because everything came from just the bare bones basics, right? That's where agriculture came from. That's where, you know, piston engines came from. It was built from the ground up, you know, over time. So I think it would be possible, and humans would find a way to recreate some of the technological implements and I think, I guess, useful or helpful tools they had before. But maybe in this sense, it would take on a different sort of perspective with that lived experience of having everything fall apart and understanding, you know, the broader picture of doing things in a better way for the greater good, right? So I think, you know, it would happen, but hopefully it would happen in a different way with, you know, the future and, you know, the wider community in mind.
Yeah. Well, Moon of the Turning Leaves to me is so timely. I mean, that's one of the reasons why you can't put this book down, because we have existential threats on our minds right now.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's climate change, you know, I know a lot of people that is something day in and day out they are focused on and thinking about, or war, or, you know, pandemics. And so your story taps into, not in a way to, you know, sell books kind of way, but in a real get down to what's important way. And that's why it's such an important and interesting and fascinating book. So we loved it. And I want to just thank you for the thoughts you've shared today, as well as the fantastic ones in this story.
Well, thanks a lot for this really interesting and invigorating conversation. Again, I just really appreciate you both taking the time to read the story and to invite me on to chat about it. It's a huge honor. So, Chimigwech, big thanks.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. And we have to tell our listeners, you have to pick up this book and get the WAB's first book as well. But this is the one that's selling right now. You're going to love it. And in the meantime, please do connect with Wagbishig Rice. You can find him on his website. That's wab.ca. He's got some videos, some news, some events that you can find on there. He has a podcast called the Story Keepers Podcast. So if you love Indigenous books, especially fiction, you can join Wab and Jennifer David as they talk about these really interesting and important subjects. And you can also find him on Facebook, Instagram, and X. It's been a lot of fun. Very great discussion here. We really enjoyed it. Thanks so much.
Likewise. Thank you very much.
Well, Chris, first of all, so many cool things came up in that conversation. In fact, you and I have been really having this ongoing conversation about a lot of things here. And the one I wanted to ask you about was this generational gap. And I love that you asked him about the respect that can go both ways, from an older generation to a younger, and also from a younger to an older. And why did you ask that question? I'm just curious, because that was a really important one in the story.
Well, yes, because it was so profound in the book. The younger people looking to the older generation for wisdom and advice, but the older generation allowing the younger generation to go off looking for civilization and trusting them to keep their group safe. And I loved that interaction. And as I was reading it, I thought, have we lost some of that today? I think we're so quick to discard our seniors because they may be physically incapable, but we forget about all the intellect and wisdom and experience that they hold inside their minds. And by the same token, I do think sometimes the older generation discounts our youth is being young and naive when maybe they do have some fresh ideas and new plans that we need to listen to. So it is definitely a back and forth that I think we tend to miss today. How do you feel, Kristen?
Yeah, well, I think also underlying all of what you said, because I agree, is an anger. And I think that some of the younger generations are angry with people who come before them because they've screwed some things up, right? We have tremendous issues in terms of defiling our waters and our air, you know, the climate change issues. These are things that people are mad about. And so, you know, while an individual person might not be responsible, the generation represents that to the younger generation. And so I think also underlying that disrespect is anger.
Mm-hmm. I also loved this in his book, and we didn't get a chance to talk about it, but there was another group in his story called the disciples. They were extremely prejudiced, hateful people. And I read that and I thought, would that happen at the ending of the world? I would hope and want to think that people would put aside whatever prejudice they may have towards another minority or person, and that we would say to each other, hey, we're all human beings. We're all left on this earth. Let's work together. But I think Wahb showed us the shallowness that can still be found in the human heart. And maybe during a crisis, out of fear, like you just said, these hate-filled people rise up with more hate. I was so shocked to see this group, but also I thought, yep, I bet Wahb is right. How did you feel about this group?
Yeah, I think it goes right back to our discussion about identity. And, you know, the minute you don't have as your primary identity, fellow human being, you now are seeking out people who have an identity with something that you identify with, like in this book, white or, you know, powerful. And they were seeking each other out and aligning themselves with those similar ideals. And of course, seeking power, because with power comes the ability to get food and water and ammo and keep themselves safe. So
fear, do you think there's an element of fear? Because I think behind every prejudice and hate, there is an element of pure ignorance towards the other culture and a fear of the unknown. So you're casting an opinion on a small group that truly you don't really know that much about, but you're afraid it's something foreign, and the ignorant person will rally the troops and form their little clicky cluster to keep anything out that they're not certain of. And I think that in the doing of that, you're missing out on a wealth of beautiful culture and information and education and way of life. And just like what Wahb showed us with the indigenous people during this crisis, that they were able to fortify and that they knew how to hunt and still take care of the land. I just thought that was a very wise trick that he put into this story to show us that prejudice could probably still exist.
Yeah, no doubt. And how much fear when you're facing something apocalyptic, you know, that ramps up any fear that you did have, because now you're thinking self-preservation and again, food and water and protection. So I agree.
The only other thing I wrote down, that there was a quote from the book that said, Mother Nature is reclaiming the land. So as I don't think it's a spoiler to say that a group leaves the indigenous community to search for life, what is going on in the world. And as they go through, they see that the branches and the trees and the vines have overtaken buildings and broken down cars, and anything that man had made is disappearing with the force and the power of nature reclaiming the land. And I just said, I love that notion, Mother Nature reclaiming the land.
Because it was an element of hope in a very hopeless situation. And it also made me think about the fact that we've created these very persistent pollutants, but even those eventually will be somehow reclaimed by nature. It'll take a long time, but eventually that will happen. And, you know, who knows if we'll be here to see that happen. But I do think that that element of hope is something that we always have to keep going back to. Otherwise, you could be in a lot of despair. Mm-hmm. About
it's a great book. Just loved having him so much.
Yeah. Well, I want to give our listeners a preview of some of the authors that we have coming up. We have the most exciting lineup. I'm just going to read some of these names because if I told you the books, we'd be here all day. We've got Nick Petrie, Susan Mallory, Ashley Elston, Liza Palmer, Lisa Unger, Heather Gudenkoff. In fact, Lisa and Heather are returning for their second time. CJ Box, second time. Benjamin Stevenson and Katie Quinn and Janie Chang, Joyce Maynard, Mary Kubica, also returning, Christopher Reich, Amiko Jean, Bonnie Jo Campbell, Dervla McTiernan, J.D. Barker, Scott Carson, who you may remember, we've had him on as Michael Carita, Kate White, also returning, Lisa Wingate, she kicked us off. We just adore these authors. B.A. Paris and Hank Philippi Ryan. What a lineup. We are so excited. And of course, listeners, we want you to stay with us and keep sharing our socials. You can find us at bookstormpodcast.com. You can find us on Instagram, on TikTok. You can find us on YouTube. We have these wonderful episodes up there. You can search through them for your favorite authors. And until next time, of course, one of the best ways to brave the storm is to dive down deep into life-changing fiction.